So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget podcast. I'm senior editor Devendra Hardawar.
And reviews editor Sherlyn Lowe.
This week, it is about a lot of things, but it is Microsoft dropping some of the biggest news, not just of the week, but of the year. Monumental news about them buying ZeniMax Media, the parent company of Bethesda, and all the studios that they're a part of that. It's just insane news. We will be diving into all that. Sherlyn will be talking about the Apple Watch SE. I believe it's your first Apple Watch that you're reviewing, Sherlyn, right?
My first Apple review whatsoever.
Oh,
holy crap. Yeah.
That's a big step. But yeah, we got Sherlyn over from the Android side, over from the dark side,
playing with reviews.
An Apple Watch. And it is funny to see Sherlyn actually enjoying this piece of, you know, stable consumer electronics. So we will be diving into all of that. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to the Engadget podcast on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. That's super helpful. And you could drop us a note at podcast@engadget.com. We record live typically every Thursday around 10 a.m. Eastern. So join us on our YouTube channel for that. So let me tell you guys about my Monday morning. I got up, I made coffee. I figured it'd be a pretty quiet week because things were super busy last week. 9 a.m. struck, and just a little piece of news dropped. Microsoft buying ZeniMax Media / Bethesda. And this is insane news. And if you're not a gamer, I can understand. It's like, oh, this just sounds like a media holding company, which it is. But it's a media company. It's a media company that contains some of the biggest and most interesting game developers around, including Bethesda Game Studios. You know, they're the ones behind all sorts of like the Elder Scrolls games. They've got Fallout, id Software, the originators of the first-person shooter. They've got Doom, Arkane. They're a smaller developer, but they made the Dishonored series, which I love so much. Machine Games is behind the new Wolfenstein reboot, which are excellent. Tango Gameworks is a Japanese developer that's made The Evil Within, and it's produced by Shinji Mikami, the Resident Evil creator. So this is huge. And this news came a day before Xbox Series X and S pre-orders went live, too. So talk about a combo of, you know, PR, of monumental partnership news or a huge acquisition, just getting people excited for buying these next-generation systems. I was a bit floored by this. I wrote up an editorial about it, too, because there's a lot going on with this deal. And we've talked a bit before about how Game Pass is kind of Microsoft's killer feature now, especially for these next generation consoles. So Game Pass, you know, it's there for a service, $10 a month. You can get access to a library of over 100 games, some EA Play games, and now they confirmed it's going to contain these games from these studios too, or at least the Bethesda games, because they're all owned by Microsoft. That is just a ton of content that, you know, you'll be able to play. The thing I really go on about is Game Pass Unlimited. It is the super Game Pass that is $15 a month that includes Xbox Live, and it also includes Game Pass for both PC and consoles. So there's a lot. There's just so much going on there. Sherlyn, does any of this mean anything to you? Because I'm still processing this news.
Yeah, you said when you were introducing this news that if I'm not a gamer, maybe I want to. I'm not a gamer, really. And I still knew that this was huge news. Because like I've even heard of the name Bethesda, even as a non-gamer.
Sure.
But that's probably because like I hang out with a lot of gamer people. And it was making the rounds on Twitter as well. So yeah, it's a big deal. You know, have said in previous episodes that I'm considering buying my first gaming console this year. The Xbox Series S was the one I was, you know, advised to get. And now one of the criticisms against it or one of the arguments to go for PS instead of Microsoft was that maybe PS titles might be more fun for me to play. And so now with this like out in the open and assuming that some of these big titles will be added to the Xbox Game Pass thing, this definitely seems like the way to go for me. If I could get a pre-order in, I'm not going to pre-order, but
Good luck with that. So they good also, luck. Yeah, they kicked off pre-orders this week too. And Microsoft's whole thing was a lot more organized because they didn't just like dump the news on Twitter and Jeff Keighley's, you know, Twitter feed. It was just like, hey, they said, I think it was like 10 or 11 a.m. on Tuesday. It's going to be at these sites. Go there, try to get your pre-order in. It worked for a lot of people. I know it's good. Always a mess, especially for such a in-demand product. So it was messy, yeah. But it was nowhere near like the disaster the PlayStation pre-orders were last week when people were just scrambling. Things were all over the place. Like nothing really made sense. So
Sony had to issue an apology, sort of. Mea culpa.
It didn't seem like we were on to a good start here. But hey,
no.
Just crazy news. And the Game Pass thing, by the way, it's Game Pass Ultimate, not Unlimited. Mm-hmm. I always get that mixed up. But this is really, here's the key, right? This acquisition just brings all these games, some of the biggest franchises around, within this game subscription service, which is relatively inexpensive. And there are potential downsides to that, too. I do feel like Microsoft may start playing the exclusivity game, you know, the exclusive game thing that Sony has been doing for a while too, which I think is not great for gamers. It's not great for consumers. It's nice for a company to say like, hey, I have Final Fantasy 16 for the next year exclusively, which PlayStation 5 will, because they debuted that in the trailer a couple weeks ago. That's not great for gamers who only have, you know, an Xbox or another system. So I do think we're moving to a stage where game exclusives kind of need to stop. But then again, I think Microsoft has long been criticized for not having those killer exclusives like Sony does. Now that they actually have these franchises, who knows what's going to happen? You know, some quick updates. They did say some of the games that were already basically scheduled to be exclusive on PlayStation 5 will still be there. Like, they're going to honor those deals. So that includes Tokyo, the next game from Tango Gameworks, and the next game from Arkane. Those are still going to be limited exclusives on PlayStation, even though they're owned by Microsoft, which is hilarious.
Must be a contract thing. It has to be like they've got contracts. They can't.
Money's already changed hands. The contract is already set. So that makes sense. But they did say, Microsoft said that they will take future titles, like making future titles cross-platform on a game-by-game basis, which could mean like the future, like a future Doom or a future Elder Scrolls may only be on Xbox for a while. And that's a potential danger there. That's all in my editorial about all this, because I think this puts Microsoft on a path that is potentially dangerous. I think it's exciting if you care about the business side of things. It could be dangerous when it comes to the consolidation of media and having so many developers and so many games under one company. Is that something that worries you, Sherlyn?
I think that the exclusivity thing, I know, is like a business strategy, but I do think, why don't, like, making it available on more platforms should mean more money, right? It should mean more people are able to buy it.
It should.
So that should be the way to go.
I think for the biggest games, that will probably be what happens. Yeah. And then Satya Nadella, I think in an interview with Bloomberg, said that their goal is to be, you know, kind of work with the ecosystem and have their content be broadly available. Right. And that's really what he's been pushing Microsoft towards. Like, not just building Windows phones. They gave up on Windows phones, but they built their apps for iOS and Android to really get, you know, get their services out there, because it matters more if people are paying Microsoft, you know, a monthly annual subscription fee for Office than if they buy Microsoft's phones. And we're waiting to see if kind of the same thing will happen for Xbox. I do think Game Pass puts Microsoft in a good place to basically continue that. And yeah, if they sell copies, even without Game Pass, if they sell copies on PlayStation 5 or wherever, that's still ultimately good for Microsoft. Yeah, so this is a long, confusing thing. Sherlyn, you had joked that this is sort of like Microsoft couldn't get TikTok. And we'll talk a little bit more about what happened to TikTok. But hey, this is a fun consolation, right? And
I don't have, we couldn't buy TikTok. So here's Bethesda instead, offering Bethesda up on another plate.
And I think that's just looking at the timing of things, that seems kind of funny. I think we've learned that this deal in particular has been in the works for, you know, several months, since I believe before the summer. And for the past few years, Microsoft has also been rumored to be, you know, trying to buy some major studios. I believe Capcom was a really strong rumor for a while, which would be kind of amazing. And honestly, they could still do that. But Capcom also, they had, what was it? Monster Hunter World was such a huge success for them. I believe one of the if not the biggest, you know, best-selling game of all time. That really,
I was just thinking
Capcom.
Street Fighter when I hear Capcom.
Street Fighter's not been selling so well.
I know.
It's mainly
not
been
lately, but
Monster
to
Hunter.
Me, that's like the game I grew up with. Yeah.
So Ben, I know you're a PC gamer. Ben, our producer, do you have any thoughts about what's going on here?
I'm actually more of a console gamer than a PC gamer, but I think the interesting thing here, I was just thinking as you were saying, Microsoft needs exclusives, that when was I introduced to the entire concept of the Xbox?
Right.
It was about 2002, 2003, maybe 2004, and it was with Halo.
Yeah.
The Halo exclusive on the Xbox was really, really consequential. Yeah. And as the main Halo trilogy has gone through its motions and it passed on to 343, we talked about how 343 has not been doing as great a job keeping up the Halo legacy as Bungie did. It makes sense that Microsoft would be looking for something to really, like, put that much more value proposition into their console, or reinforce the value proposition of possible exclusives for their console.
Yeah, and this is a little different than just like Halo, right? Because Halo was, that was an in-house thing. It was built by Bungie, and they brought in Bungie because Bungie was making, what was it, Marathon, I believe, for Max in the 90s. So they brought in Bungie to do this. But Halo was a property, you know, that premiered on the Xbox. That was a big thing. All these other games, Wolfenstein, Doom, Elder Scrolls, these are things that we're used to seeing on PC and elsewhere and other consoles. For it to just be in Microsoft, that's an interesting change. It's a potentially, you know, bad change for Sony, because it means that they're going to have to start working with Microsoft to get these games. But it just seems crazy. This is a deal on the level of like the Disney-Pixar relationship. I believe this was a $7 billion plus deal. So it was more than Disney played for Lucasfilm.
Yeah. So we were talking about that in the production meeting yesterday, and so I looked up some of the numbers, and actually, so yes, this is significantly larger than LucasArts, because LucasArts was about
LucasArts is different. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, LucasArts is a subsidiary.
I don't even think they exist anymore, but yeah.
Okay, I'm thinking about
you're thinking
Star
about
Wars,
the 90s.
Shadows of the Empire for Nintendo 64, excuse me. The scale of the Lucasfilm deal was about $1, maybe $1.5 billion. And so this is more on the scale of Disney Pixar, as you said. It's actually very, very similar. I think this deal with Bethesda was about $7.4 billion, and the Disney Pixar deal was $7.5 billion.
Okay.
So, like, what is $100 million?
The Lucasfilm thing was $4 billion, by the way. But yeah, that is, it's all big money. Like, money, what does any of this thing matter? You know, when we're talking about billions of dollars. But yeah, this is a huge freaking deal. We're going to see the impact of this acquisition for years. This is a sea change in the way the game industry works. So it'll be interesting. Listeners, I want to know too, does this affect how you're thinking of the next generation consoles? Email us at podcast@engadget.com. We'd love to be chatting about this. There's just so much to get excited about and so much to get worried about too. So we briefly mentioned that, hey, Microsoft didn't end up getting TikTok. Like, a lot of our reporting and a lot of the drama around this, really, that's where this all started. So now TikTok is partially owned by Oracle and Walmart, question mark?
So strange. It's a very weird turn of events. I wasn't expecting this to be the ending of the story. But there we go. What was it, like 20% is held by...
They're both getting a 20% investment stake in the newly formed TikTok Global Company. And Oracle is going to be TikTok's secure cloud provider. Basically, you know, there is no shutdown. The president has basically approved the deal in concept, although he was trying to find kickbacks from it because, of course...
trying to get money out of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, hey, TikTok's still around, now partially owned by Oracle and Walmart. It's just
I guess strange. My question to our listener and our live viewers is, does this make you feel better about TikTok now? Are you more likely to use it now that it's partially owned by Oracle and Walmart, which, by the way, most major retailers like this have been collecting your data for like longer than the digital revolution. So enjoy that.
There was a great quote from Larry Ellison, who's the billionaire, you know, in charge, the billionaire CEO of Oracle. And he had a great quote, too, that just sounded like of old guy trying to, you know, basically justify
be with
this.
The youngs.
Like, well, not even be with the youngs, but he was like, oh, yes, TikTok will, you know, our global cloud platform is certainly, you know, fitting for TikTok's blah, 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 blah. It just sounded like, oh, this is one of the people now in charge of the, you know, the social network that is so popular with the youth. Clearly, this all makes sense. You know, he knows what's up with the kids. I just found it hilarious.
Yep. But the good news is, for now, it seems like American users can still perform their dance challenges and share them on TikTok. But hopefully you want to be careful about when you watch the service, right? Devinder, you were sharing like a disturbing story about the content that sometimes surfaces on TikTok.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about the power of TikTok as the power of the algorithm, and the way the algorithm can, you know, what can get popular in TikTok is not just super popular people with a ton of followers, but it can be a small thing from an account with very few followers that the algorithm lifts up and brings to other accounts, and people share and share and share, yada, yada, yada. The problem is, this algorithm is so good, it's also kind of uncontrollable. And I think a couple weeks ago, there was a story of a guy who committed suicide on TikTok. It was Facebook Live, but the video made it over to TikTok, and it just kept getting shared and shared and shared, and people would like put in filler opening videos so that you couldn't tell that's where it was going.
Whoa,
and then
that's
like
rude.
Clip in the stuff at the end. So all this stuff, like anything in the media and social media, there's potential for abuse. And this algorithm, you know, TikTok is trying to stop this video, but they had a hard time doing it because they can't control directly the algorithm. You can't just of the way TikTok is built around sharing and resharing and constant sharing like that, it is tough to just stop one thing if people are rebadging it, changing the video a little, or changing the music. So that's a potential downside. I hope the company is looking at that situation, because every social network has dealt with this. It's not just them, but it does seem like their virality, it's like a viral engine is uncontrollable. So, who knows if they can get some control over that eventually. Sherlyn, do you want to talk about your Apple Watch SE? Because I'm interested in your very first, baby's first Apple review, basically.
It's an experience. It is.
You're like software that's so polished and shiny. It's not crashing all the time.
Don't tell people I admitted that. No, I'm kidding. This is my first review of an Apple Watch. I've had limited experience with Apple Watches in the past. And, you know, I'm the lead wearables reviewer on Engadget. And we've been trying to make sure that I get, significant time with an Apple Watch for a while, because it's only fair and it will inform my experience with other devices. So I have the Apple Watch SE. This is a 40 millimeter size,
a small one,
with a braided solo loop, and it's gosh, it's nice.
It's nice.
I've said before that I know and am aware and actually believe that the Apple Watch is the best smartwatch in the space. But now, having spent an extended amount of time with the Watch SE, I see why. I get it.
Yeah,
it's
you get why every
place.
Other smartwatch has died and only Apple has survived. Yeah.
Well, there are certain things that I think Samsung does better. The Tizen OS is just easier to use. There's fewer things you need to do to get to like a widget. For example, I wanna add my water intake or something. But what really is great about Apple Watch's ecosystem is that, oh my gosh, this thing flies. It's really fast. B, it works so well with like your iPhone. Siri is pretty smart. With watchOS 7, they've moved certain dictation's moved on device.
Yep.
So the processing is just so fast. Siri is also really accurate at understanding what I'm saying, which is surprising.
And by the way, before Siri, you had to, like, when you did hit Siri on the Apple Watch, it would hit your iPhone. Like, it would go back to the phone to kind of do the work. And there was always delay with that. It was always a little slow. So, hey, now that's faster. It's straight up like my dreams of being Michael Knight in Knight Rider and just, like, talking to my watch and my robots. Yeah, it's coming true.
Your smartwatch dreams are coming true. And I think that, like, every review that I do, I have a moment where I kind of sit and I'm like, what am I going to, like, what is the message, right? And that was my message, which was, like, what does this watch represent? And for a lot of people, it might be their first Apple Watch because this is the cheaper $279 version as opposed to the $400 Series 6.
Right.
And it just tells me how far Apple has come in the smartwatch making game. This thing... You don't have, there's so much fewer delays. There are so few pauses and stutters. Everything that I expect to work works more or less the way it should. And, you know, even though it's kind of super small, this thing just feels really dense. It feels so well made. I don't know. I don't want to, like, go on and on.
It feels so solid. I mean, you're talking about all the things people have been saying about the Apple Watch. I think since the very first one, although it's gotten faster and more stable. Like, I bought the first one. It felt good. Like, as a device, it felt good. The software was just slow, you know?
Apple's always made, like, good, like, feeling. The things just feel well put together. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Software has had its issues. Certain features were missing, etc. I still prefer Tizen's bezel interface where you can, like, flick it around and go and, you know, swipe through a lot of pages at once.
This may be the first
crown
time
doesn't really work like this.
Sherlyn, this is the first time anybody has said I still prefer Tizen anything.
Oh, I still I will say Samsung's spinning bezel, everyone has been
it's still the best way
to interact with a watch.
I don't mind the crown, and in fact I like the way the crown, like the little dial on the Apple Watch, feels like an actual watch dial, whereas the bezel thing on Samsung, based on what I saw, like, a couple years ago with some of the, I think, the second gen Samsung watches, like, it was fine, but those things are so thick. Like, that's the thing. Even when you showed off the Samsung watch with us, it's too thick on your wrist. It looks bad. Whereas you look at the Apple Watch, it's a lot lower profile. It seems more fitting to being a smart device in 2020, right?
So the Watch 3, yes, they've made the bezel slimmer and smaller and lighter. And it still was a chunky watch.
Boy.
It's chunky baby.
Yeah.
And yes, I agree that the digital crown is lower profile. It is not as easy to use because it doesn't offer you as much, like, room to kind of, like, work with.
Sure.
But it's, again, up to you. If you're an Android person, the Apple Watch still isn't going to be good for you. So you're still going to go with, like, something like the Galaxy Watch. The Watch Active 2, however, does have sort of that spinning bezel interface with the touch bezel rather than a physical spinning wheel. And I don't like that as much, but it's there also if you need it. Anyway, just, like, to quickly break down what are some of the things that are that are coming out of this experience with Apple Watch SE. With Watch OS 7, which, you know, launches with this watch, and the Series 6, you get sleep tracking, right? Mm-hmm. And listeners of this podcast know about my love-hate relationship with that. And I also recently reviewed the Fitbit Sense, which does a different, like, a more in-depth sort of sleep tracking. So the WatchOS 7 one night, I put it on, I went to bed. Uh-huh. I was like, oh, grumbling. I don't want to wear a watch to bed, but I did it. Next morning, I woke up, I was like, okay, after this night of terrible sleep, let's take a look at, like, what the WatchOS is, what the Watch SE is going to tell me. It didn't track anything. Why? Because I was a dummy, plus there wasn't a step in the setup process that was, like, enable sleep tracking.
Oh.
But you have to. And I was,
That's good for privacy in that it's asking you to do that, but yeah, you had to do that extra step. Sorry.
I agree. No. I mean, yeah, we were saying, like, in our production call, you were like, no, totally, Apple should be able to, like, it says automatic sleep tracking. It should be automatic.
I think once you confirm it, I didn't know where you were in the setup process, but I feel like once you're being like, okay, you could do all this stuff, Apple, just let, you know,
right. And then I was like, I see the total, like, the point of the, you know, Apple's whole thing is being cautious about your privacy, about your permissions. So they want you to actively be like, be aware we're going to track your sleep. Mm-hmm. So this step, I get the whole theory behind it. It was just a moment of like in the review process, this was frustrating. Anyway, I enabled it and then it's tracked my sleep. It's not as accurate, I feel, as the others that I've tested, the Fitbit Sense and the Galaxy Watch are a little bit better at it because they actually use your heart rate mm-hmm. and calculate your sleep zones. Whereas this thing, first of all, you set up like a wind down, here, time to go to bed feature.
I kind
of
like that. And I do like that. I've been using it on my phone and just like it makes the like little lullaby sounds like, oh, it is 1:15 a.m. and I've been writing all night. Maybe I should leave this computer, you know?
It's great on your phone. Yeah. It's not good on your watch because mm-hmm. it doesn't do anything on my watch other than like D&D, like blocks all notifications. I'm like, great. I don't want to be woken up later on. So I set my late bedtime to 1 a.m., which is, I know it's late for most people, sure. but it's early for me. And what it does is it just starts counting as if you were sleeping from 1 a.m.
Yeah. It's not, just like, it's not smart.
No, it's not actually in bed.
Yeah.
Right. So then it notices that, like, it will notice breaks in the time and it will, you know, log those. But ultimately, it told me I slept a lot longer than I actually did, which was I went to bed at, like, 2:30 or something. I don't know. But, yeah, I'm still not fully convinced that Apple's sleep tracking is better than the rest yet.
Sure.
Obviously, I think others do better on that. And this is something they can improve on for the next one.
This is Fitbit. Fitbit was the one who started the trackers like back
when they were competing with
Jawbone and with the mm-hmm. Aria, like back when fitness trackers were big on this. Fitbit has been doing it forever, so they have the most. I believe they also bought some companies too for better sleep tracking and for better.
It's entirely possible.
Yeah,
I think that the sleep tracker is a better device to wear to bed than a watch.
Oh,
but
yeah.
We can go on about that. Talking about Fitbit, I just finished reviewing the Fitbit Sense. That thing, I mean, gosh, I love the sleep insights you get from that. Honestly, I don't like wearing anything to bed, but on my watch, on my wrist. But the Fitbit Sense, when you do get the results, they're so, like, I spent some time looking at, I was in REM sleep for that long. Oh, yeah. I was in restorative sleep for that long. That was so great to see. And Samsung also does this, which is nice.
I feel like there should be a mode for these watches where you just slip it into your pillow, maybe, or something like a charging thing that sits under you or near you while you're sleeping, so it can actually track.
Right, since I can actually remove the strap and just use the case, that would be a really smart piece of software if they ever came up with it.
But it can't. Does the Apple Watch do oxygen tracking too?
No, not the SE. Well, not the SE. Not the SE. The Series 6 has the blood oxygen and the ECG. So between the SE and the Series 6, your main difference is the lack of ECG. Mm-hmm. You don't have a blood oxygen sensor. Also, you don't have you have a different processor.
Yeah.
But this, the one that's on the SE, is speedy.
Still
as fast. Anyway.
That was last year's processor. So now it's on this. That's good. I do wonder what blood oxygen, what that could add to sleep tracking, because I am somebody who constantly worries, like, do I have sleep apnea? I don't know.
I mean,
I've never gone through a test, but that's all about oxygen monitoring and everything. And I snore a lot sometimes, so that makes me worried. And your only solution to that is to get the mask, whatever you call that.
It is the
sleep apnea mask that has the machine that kind of pumps. CPAP. It kind of pumps for you. I do feel like we are waiting for a company to do like a smart CPAP thing, because a lot of people sleep terribly. A lot of people snore. And just making people sleep better would be like a monumental thing. I think Philips or some other companies have come up with them, but they're like $500 plus, you know?
So what Fitbit does is it has, I think, what looks like an experimental snore detection feature. I turned on and I don't snore, so like obviously it didn't detect anything. I know this for a fact. And Fitbit's issue, though, my issue with Fitbit, and you can see this in the review that went up on Engadget.com, is that like the way it detects or tracks your blood oxygen is only at night. Which the company told me the reason they do this is that like your blood oxygen levels don't change a lot during the day.
Right.
And really, if you're tracking at night, what you're doing is you're getting a baseline read and then you compare your variations. And that's how you detect things like sleep apnea or other respiration issues. Mm-hmm. So I think that is fine. You might want to consider the Sense if you're really that concerned. I don't know how Apple and Samsung with their blood oxygen, they're detecting more throughout the day. It takes Apple just 15 seconds. It takes Samsung more or less around the same time to get a reading. Which you're just going to get a result that tells you, like, you're good, more or less.
You're good.
So I don't know. Yeah.
I think another good thing about Fitbit, too, is it's good for being cross-platform, where if you are somebody who doesn't know if you're going to stick with iOS or stick with Android, I know the Samsung stuff works with iOS too, Sherlyn. You mentioned that, but I have a feeling that it still works best with Android and all the Android widgets, right?
So we've discussed this before. Every smartwatch that's not an Apple Watch works better with Android because it's more open. It allows you to dictate replies and stuff like that, whereas iOS doesn't. But obviously, Fitbit can also work with an iOS or iPhone if you want to, and you can still get those insights. I wanted to say a really quick thing about the Fitbit, which is it's just comparing the Fitbit, moving from the Fitbit to the Apple Watch, I think is part of the reason why I was so amazed at the Apple Watch. Because Fitbit's OS is limited. It's very, it's raw. It's kind of unrefined.
It's kind of, and it's a shame in 2020, Fitbit's software is still so
Right, they bought Pebble so just for the software. And they did very little with it, except for open up like HTML developer platform for like easier app writing, which is great. But anyway, one last thing that I really liked about the Apple Watch, though, is, you know, people keep talking about closing your ring. That's like...
it's another game. We found another game for Shilin to be obsessed with. It is the ring game. So tell me, did you just walk around in circles for a full day?
I did walk around in circles for quite a lot of the day.
I could literally see how this plays out. Like, fully predict this.
I just walk up, I go grab like a glass of water, and I start pouring it, but like I walk around as I pour it. I'm just like, let's do this. No, but what's been even more fun is at the start of my review process, Chris Velasco, our senior mobile editor and also Apple Watch user, was like, Chris Velasco has invited you to share your activity. Oh God, the second that happened, he and I are both like so competitive now with each other. Like he'll go for a bike ride at the end of the day just to like match. I added Valentina Palladino and other like Apple Watch users on the Engadget team. And yeah, we have like I have a mini competition going on with everyone. So Valentina always kicks butt. She's always like
Never try to out-exercise Valentina because she is always moving.
She starts her day. So I also get alerts when all these people finish their workouts now because we're sharing info. I wake up every morning to Valentina already having completed like two runs or something. Like, I'm just like, no, I just woke up. So that's really fun. And it's not that Fitbit doesn't offer competition in its service. There is a Fitbit community that allows for that. It's just not as baked in.
You're starting to see the Apple spell, Sherlyn. Like it's the baked in. It's so nice. Yes. It just works. It's a lot of that is the reason people stick with Apple. Yeah.
What it is I knew in theory before, and then having it now, and also being a person who has reviewed a lot of other smartwatches. It's more that like because I've seen what's not so great coming to something that's really well done feels like such a huge difference.
You know what's funny is that you being an Android expert has made you in a way appreciate iOS and watchOS more.
Like I'm primed to love watchOS more. I did already write an article like in June that watchOS 7 might be what gets me to move over to iOS. I will say, dear listener and viewer, don't worry, I am not a traitor. I am still going to stick to Android. But this thing really tells me a lot.
But now your life is filled with regret. You're just like, man, I wish.
I'm just going to have two phones and two watches because the iPhone can be my work phone.
You'll have the good phone and the bad phone. Gotcha.
That's so mean. That's not true. The good watch and the bad watch, maybe.
Talking about bad phones, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Or other...
You're being mean again.
tell me about the Samsung Galaxy Impact for Every Fan event in which they announced another goddamn phone.
So Samsung, announced the Impact event for Every Fan. It was Wednesday or Tuesday at like whatever time.
Wouldn't the fans already own the phones? Like why are you hosting an event year
that's
after...
That's the question... the question that everyone has been asking since they talked about the S20 FE, which is the fans want the higher end phone. Well, the S20 FE stands for Fan Edition, and it's $699, so it's like $700, which is $200 cheaper than the S20-ish. And it's got like 6.5 inch screen, but 1080p instead of quad HD. You get like the same processor, but the camera, the camera that's the telephoto lens is a little less sharp. It's 8 megapixels actually. If I'm not 100% sure on the
I want to cock my head like an owl and just like full like what? None of this makes sense.
It's a very, because to me, is a strange, yeah, it's a strange mix and hodgepodge of
it's,
sexy.
It's just a
together.
Cheaper S20, right? But don't they already have a cheaper S20?
No, they have the S20, S20 Plus, and S20 Ultra. Oh,
okay, okay.
So now you got the cheap FE S20. And let's talk about why the hell they named this FE. Because we were saying it's clearly not so-called for the fans, like they're trying to tell you.
Uh-huh.
We had a briefing with Samsung, and someone asked Samsung, hey, why are you calling it the FE?
Yeah.
They're like, well, because we did market research and the word light doesn't do so well. And the word E doesn't do great. And so we're going to go with FE because FE tracks well with people. We're like, yeah, it tracks well with people because they think you're going to stuff it with special bonus features. Like, or like BTS
give us
edition.
Like a special
or
edition phone with the new processor, something that the people who bought it early didn't get, right?
Right. And I think it's also kind of a take on Apple's SE, right? We've got the Apple Watch SE. We've got the you know, iPhone SE.
Are you saying so, Samsung may be copying Apple in some respects? That's unfounded.
I mean, that's totally nothing.
Never happened
that
before.
No one in the industry has ever done before.
Yeah.
I mean, SE, FE even sounds a little bit like SE.
No, it does.
Think about it.
It does.
So let's. I think that's what they were going for. So let's see if they continue this naming, because Samsung has tried a lot of different names for its budget phones now, and it's
right.
None of them have really stuck. The other thing, too, is with this phone, we've got the total number of phones launched this year by Samsung just in the flagship lines.
Uh-huh.
It's up to 8, okay? So, yeah. Like, I'm going to run this down. Galaxy S20, S20 Plus, S20 Ultra, Z Flip. Then we had the Note 20, Note 20 Ultra, the Galaxy Z Fold 2, and now the S20 FE.
You're not even counting, like, the A line, which is the whole...
Yo, yeah. Not even the A line. And then I tweeted this out, and I got, like, all kinds of, like, all around the world, people are like, not even the M51, the N9.
Yeah,
I was like,
yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Guys, I know there's a lot of
phones.
Other
markets,
I'm just counting
the
top ones. But, like, holy crap, Samsung. And, I mean, I agree they used to do, like, carrier versions of specific phones, so it's already, like, a drop.
And there are 5G variants this year, too, right? Because
for some of the phones, there are. I think the Z Flip comes in a Z Flip 5G.
Yeah.
But, anyhow, Samsung, y'all, you got a lot of assembly lines going on right there.
So what is the price of this phone? Because I feel like $699. This is their... How does this compare to the Pixel 4a, which is $350 and is our perfect, lovely, cheap boy?
So biggest difference I think you'll see is the processor is actually different.
Uh-huh.
There is the 865 on the S20 FE, and you know Google uses more like a 700 level, but Google really, you can't really tell the difference. The software runs really well on the 4a. Another huge difference, camera. You get additional sensors with the S20 FE, which offers you a bit more flexibility and versatility in your shooting. But again, Google has done such a great job with the one sensor that I, you know, much as I would like a wide angle lens for landscapes, I don't feel like I'm missing out.
I kind of trust Google's software more than Samsung's multiple sensors, especially like I think I was watching reviews of the latest Note, right? And the camera stuff seems weird. It just seems like Samsung is doing weird processing to a lot of things in a not great way.
Samsung, with Samsung, your selfies are always going to look a little bit artificially tweaked, just a bit. And the rest of it, though, I mean, there's like some sort of artifacts in processing. Samsung has tamped that down a lot, but I kind of see it as like one of the things is the way they render color.
Mm-hmm.
And I see the approach of Samsung versus Google and versus the iPhone cameras on color as similar to that philosophy of Canon versus Nikon or something like that.
Bolder
like,
versus Canon's more muted.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it's really up to your own preference sometimes. And I think Samsung users are either already used to it or they have found their own workarounds or they like it. And everyone else that prefers like natural, more neutral colors are going to prefer something like, I mean, okay, we don't even talk about the Huawei phones. The Huawei phones are oversaturated a lot
sure,
of the times.
Sure, sure. I mean, yeah, so it is sort of like, mild. It is like looking at TV screens too. It's like if you look at a TV screen in Best Buy or something, it's too bright. The color is cranked up way too much. Like that's how people try to sell you on screen. So I get it. Sheldon, are there going to be any other Samsung events this year? Because I'm done with Samsung. I don't want to talk about Samsung anymore.
So we usually see Samsung do a developer conference in November. You know, everyone's all like, where's that Galaxy homeboy? Where's that Galaxy? Uh-huh. You know? So we don't know whether they'll have another.
Where are the Tizen fans at?
Where the Bixby, where's the Bixby speaker? Maybe there'll be a Bixby
does
fridge.
Does not exist. Does not exist.
I mean, the Bixby fridge probably does exist, actually.
I don't know if you've seen Popstar Never Stopping yet, Sherlyn, which is a masterpiece of comedy and one of the greatest American movies ever made of the past 10 years, at least. Okay. But there's a point where they make a joke about a smart fridge and how smart fridges go haywire when you send songs over a bad firmware update. I see the Bixby fridge. That is the Bixby fridge. That is a fridge with a speaker in it for some reason that you talk to and Samsung sends an update and it just plays music every time you open it way too loud.
That is.
Samsung's going to do that. Terrifying. You heard it here first. I predict it. It's worth mentioning, as you're hearing this, you're probably going to see a lot of news about new Amazon devices. We are recording this on Thursday morning, literally hours before the Amazon event starts. So unfortunately, we cannot talk about the new Amazon stuff, which is a shame. And hey, I'm just going to throw some ideas out there. Probably new Echoes, probably new smart features, probably some smart devices that nobody will give a crap about, but Samsung is crazy enough to make. So the smart can
Amazon,
opener.
Not Samsung.
Let's throw some ideas out there. What are you thinking?
Smart curtains have been done, probably.
That's good. Smart curtains are done. Yeah.
Yeah. A smart drying rack, because Amazon Basics' clothes drying rack is pretty freaking good.
So you can get some smart air on your wet clothes. Smart air.
Or like moisture detection, and then tell I can't say the word Alexa, but tell Alexa that you want she can tell you when your clothes are dry.
I mean, that's one thing. I sent a note to Scott Stein over at CNET because he was wondering what sort of crazy things were popping up to. I propose the Echo Lou, which is a smart bidet that tracks your excrement, therefore tracking your nutrition levels and everything you've eaten, and also automatically starts building a shopping list for you based on what you've already eaten.
Amazing.
I feel like that is the full circle.
You need more fiber in
going straight
diet.
To Whole Foods. It's a full circle Amazon ecosystem right there. Echo Lou, bidets are hot now in the pandemic era.
Speaking of that whole ecosystem thing, with Amazon having announced the Halo wearable with like health tracking and like tone detecting weirdly.
Tone detection, mansplaining.
I know.
Yeah, built in.
I can see their new like controversial product being the Echo Weighing Scale.
I mean, that's
BMI is too high. Time to not buy so much candy from Whole Foods.
Because those have existed for years, so I'm sure. Actually, I think you're right, Sherlyn. They could easily
that might
add
come
that.
Out.
Yeah,
that would be a very obvious thing for them to make. But if the rest of you watching or listening have any ideas as to what might come out of the Amazon event, feel free to send them our way.
There were some
by
leaks.
The time
the Fire TV Stick Lite, a cheaper version of the Fire TV. That is one thing. That's a smart product to launch, just because Roku has a whole bunch of cheap sticks now. Like, cheap streaming sticks are all over the place. They make great gifts. They're easy to install. So that makes sense. Yeah.
And we saw that Google is announcing a new Chromecast at its event next week, too. This is going to go up against that.
That is next week's news. We're going to be all in on Google, and that's going to be fun. I do like the one thing Google does pretty well is the whole Chromecast platform, even though they killed Chromecast audio, and that still hurts. But yeah, Chromecast, hopefully they keep building on that. Anything else you want to mention about Amazon, Sherlyn?
I don't know. By the time this episode is up and people are listening to it on whatever podcast platform, you'll already know. But just keep sending those wild ideas to us. Maybe one of them will be picked up by Amazon and you can claim bragging rights to having thought of it first.
I think one fun thing is let's collect some ideas. We could go start talking to smart gadget companies and see who wants to build some of these things. My Echo Lou will be real one day. One day. Actually, I have a Toto bidet on one of my bathrooms. So, that is That thing, I wrote about that for Engadget. One of my favorite, one of my favorite gadget purchases of the past few years is a freaking bidet, because in the middle of winter, you want something warm on your butt. That is it. This is my, that's all you want.
I can't.
That's all you want. Let's move in to what we've been working on. And, you know, things I'm doing when I'm not sitting on my Toto bidet is testing the Razer Blade 2020. Which is their latest blade with the RTX 2080 chip and a 300 hertz screen. So I'm going to be working on a review for that soon. It is super cool. I'm testing one of the first Intel Evo laptops. I don't need to keep it secret. It is the Asus ZenBook Flip S, which is super cool. So I'm going to, that's going to be a full review. I'm going to be out next week, but I'll have a review for that in at some point. I'm really digging this. And also last week I tested out that Intel Tiger Lake prototype machine. These things feel so fast. And this machine in particular feels so super thin while also moving really quickly. It is, it's a computer where almost the instant I flip up the screen, it just pops on into the login screen or into like Windows Hello to get me to the desktop. Like
I want to I would love to see how fast that compares to existing, like, not to say Windows on Snapdragon, but a lot of the ultrabooks I've used lately are pretty fast already, so it'd be nice to see.
It's like the new big thing. So yeah, testing those two things. Certainly, I mean, what else is new? There's gonna be a lot of stuff coming. I am preparing for the onslaught of console reviews, which are certainly going to hit us towards the middle and end of October. That's going to be a big thing. Look out for our content around all of that. Sherlyn, what's up with you?
Yeah, in addition to reviewing the Apple Watch SE, now that the Fitbit Sense review has gone up, I am working on a lot of embargoed stuff as per usual that I can never say. I'm the secret keeper. I have only a lot of secrets. But everyone knows that Google's event is next week on Wednesday, so I am obviously also preparing for that. It's like studying for an exam.
Yeah.
This is our job. I have to like do all the research and revision and write a lot of stuff. I'm very sure we will have all the coverage for you. We will be watching that event live most probably. So stay tuned for a link from us or, you know, subscribe to our YouTube channel to get notified when we go live so you can watch it with us. It'll be fun. Devendra, you said you won't be around next week, right?
I won't. Oh, I forgot this Google event was happening. But yeah, it's okay. I will not be around, but hopefully you guys will be fine. Enjoy the Android
stuff.
We will
be okay. I know. We will be. We will hopefully be okay and hopefully have plenty of help from the rest of our coworkers so you can take some well-deserved time off.
Woo! I'm just going to be playing a lot of games. That's me. But okay, do you have any picks you want to talk about, Sherlyn? What's up this week?
Yeah, so I mean, we all heard the really sad news over, I think, the weekend that Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed, and I, you know, saw that over the weekend too. A lot of people were playing the RBG documentary.
Yeah.
And
by the way, smart move, Hulu, like who is streaming the RBG doc, straight up right to the front page, like immediately that night, and it makes sense because a lot of people want to find this thing. Yeah.
I know that everyone is aware of the RBG documentary. I mean, a lot of networks were streaming it for free. Hulu did, like Devendra said, put it front and center for the weekend as well. So you know it's a good documentary. You've probably already seen it. But I wanted to point out my personal connection to this documentary. One of the directors, Betsy West, was my RW1 professor at school, at J School. And Julie Cohen, her co-director, it was also one of our professors at the school. So, you know, it's nice to see my the person who taught me everything I know about video production, a.k.a. none of the skills I use today, be, you know, have her work be celebrated and also have worked with such an amazing inspiration. Like, she spent so much time with RBG collecting all of that, you know, information about her life and her legacy. So just check it out if you haven't already.
I'm so glad this movie was made, by the way. Like, it's,
I know,
it seems like it's been something people were trying to do for a while, and I'm glad this, you know, was able to happen shortly before her death. Yeah,
I'm glad. Yeah, they were able to do that in like such a timely fashion too. And it was wild to see like my professors on the red carpets and winning Emmys and stuff, even though they've already won a lot of awards.
Sure.
It's just they're like, all right, y'all are now like even more a big deal than you were.
Yeah,
when you were
this movie was a box office hit too, so it put them in a place to make a lot more documentaries, you know, so that's a lot of clout within the movie industry. Yeah,
I want to also recommend something a little less heavy, or a little less inspirational. Yeah. I want to see. Yeah. And I don't want to sound rude to follow up RBG with this, but Devendra, you'll be happy to know that I watched recently the Fast Times Live table read that was on YouTube. Okay. Have you heard of that?
I've heard. I mean, there have been a lot of table reads. I have not seen this one, but yeah, this one. I like Fast Times. It's fine.
Huge names, like
yeah, big names.
I mean,
it's their thing.
And everyone went wild for the Jen Aniston and Brad Pitt reunion moment on there that was kind of slightly awkward, because I'm sure you remember the iconic scene, because I've never watched Fast Times at Ridgemont High. This was my first ever encounter with.
Wait,
the
so
movie.
You haven't even seen the movie, but you
I
watched
know,
this live
I've
screen.
Never. Yes. I never watched the movie, but I watched the table read, and it was awkward as hell, but also great. Shia LaBeouf, I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce his
Shia
name.
Shia LaBeouf, come on.
LaBeouf,
Shirlin.
My bad.
Shirlin, he did not work his butt off since he was a child for you to call him Shia LaBeouf. Come on.
Well, there's a lot of people whose names get mispronounced all the time. Andrzej Parek on the Emmys also had his name mispronounced despite winning a very important award. So let's put that out there. I'm sorry, Shia LaBeouf was also really great in character as Spicoli. This was my introduction to all these characters you guys have known for a long time, and this was
you're taking the route that I'm sure a lot of like Gen Z folks are doing too,
possibly.
Who have probably not seen this movie, but who knows? Because listen, the Youngs have latched onto The Office as their new nostalgic look at
Friends,
yeah,
which is strange.
And Friends. So who knows? Maybe this is for me. This was my nostalgic look at like the 80s when I was, you know, a 90s kid. So yeah, okay.
So now that you said Gen Z kids are picking it up, can I classify myself as Gen Z? Like I'm Gen
you're
Z,
right? You're in a generation of your own, Trillin. Let's put it that
That's
way.
That's true. Wow. What do you recommend people watch?
So I have been previewing a show that's going to be premiering on Amazon this Friday, and that is the remake of the British series Utopia, and it is freaking astounding. Like, it's very good. Ooh. I tried to watch the original show, and I know a lot of people who loved it. The caveat of this show is that basically it seems like a straight up, you know, almost direct remake of everything happening, in the original series. But just I love how well done it is. So first of all, this is a Utopia remake by Gillian Flynn. It's written by Gillian Flynn, so like, you know, the person who brought Gone Girl to life and everything. The author of Gone Girl. It is a show about a group of comic nerds who are obsessed with a comic called Utopia because they think it can help them predict how the world is going to end. And it is a show, it's a hard show to watch now because it's all about pandemics. It's all about like the things and the impending apocalypse that we're facing. But I like the characters. I think the writing is super strong.
It
has a great cast.
Incredible.
Yeah, it looks great. It has a great cast, including John Cusack as like a super rich pharma bro who may or may not be in charge of this. Rainn Wilson is in it as a like biotechnology guy. And just something for me. One of the lead roles is played by Sasha Lane, I believe her name is. And she was, she's a tremendous actor who first appeared on American Honey, like an independent movie I loved from a couple of years ago. So just great cast all around. Great like end of the world stuff. If you like good thrillers, if you like apocalyptic thrillers, and it's really deeply embedded in like fan culture and stuff too. If you've ever loved, something so much, if you've been a fanboy or fangirl or something, and you feel like your devotion to it could help you unlock the secrets of the world, which I've certainly felt with some shows, namely Neon Genesis Evangelion. Things like that. If you've ever had that fan culture, I think you'll really appreciate Utopia. So check it out on Amazon starting Friday.
I actually can't wait to watch this. It looks like the sort of sci-fi TV show I've been looking for instead of watching Ghost Hunters, which I just started.
Stop watching
Ghost
Hunters.
Watching on Hulu. Wow. I'll watch this one instead. For once, I will listen to one of your recommendations. That's it for our show this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at...
at Devendra on Twitter, a podcast about movies and TV at slashfilm.com, at the slashfilmcast. If you want to hear me talk about The Legend of Korra, which is incredible, I'm at Republic City Dispatch. Just Google that and you'll find our show.
And if you can hold off on sending me all the different types of phones Samsung has made in your country, that would be great. You can find me on Twitter at Sherlyn Low. Feel free to send me tips on where to find the best Malaysian food in the U.S. as well. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe, please, on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify.